Hello and welcome to the Women's Hour. I'm Kelly Pyle, your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. Today's show features articles from the April 28th issue of People magazine and the May edition of Real Simple. Some of the articles I'll be sharing with you today include Christy Brinkley, Life is an Adventure, The Lost Daughter, and Prince Harry's High Stakes Fight. Christy Brinkley, Life is an Adventure. In a new memoir, the supermodel details her roller coaster life, her epic romance with Billy Joel, and why, as 71, she feels the best is yet to come. By Liz McNeil, this is a People magazine exclusive. Christy Brinkley wasn't sure what her three children might say when they read her new memoir, Uptown Girl. Then she heard from her daughter, Alexa Ray Joel. "I said, Mom, you really spilled the tea," recalls Alexa Ray, 39. "What do you mean, tea?" Brinkley asked. "What kind of tea?" As Alexa Ray explained with a laugh, "Mom, it means the revealing stuff. That was very emotional." In her bombshell new book, the 71-year-old supermodel writes about the cruelty and abuse of her biological father, Herb Hudson, the 1994 helicopter crash that nearly killed her, and her famous love affairs. From the disastrous, there were some doozies, she says, to the dazzling. One of the loves of her life was Billy Joel, the wisecracking piano man from Long Island who made her swoon and laugh. "How could I not fall in love with him?" she says. Mom to Alexa Ray, Jack, 29, and Sailor, 26. She also shares a poignant regret about her four marriages and divorces. "The one role I never got to play was wife until death do us part." Now the swimsuit siren, who's graced more than 500 magazine covers, bears all for the first time. "I figure if you're gonna write a memoir, it's the highs and the lows, the heartbreak and the love," she says. "You've got to be honest." And so that's what I did. I went there. Born in Michigan, Christy moved to L.A. with parents Marjorie Bowling and Herb Hudson when she was 6 months old. My mom and Herb were married for at least a decade until they got divorced when I was 8. Nearly every night after Herb came home from work as a milkman, he took off his belt and whipped me. Other nights, he'd take me into the bathroom and wash my mouth out with soap, scouring until I tasted lye. It didn't matter how good or quiet I was, Herb always seemed to find a reason to punish me. The last time she saw him was in an L.A. County courtroom just before her mom married TV writer Don Brinkley in 1962. She said Herb had decided he didn't have the time to take care of us, and Don was going to be our new dad. "Do you realize that you're about to give up your full parental rights to Christy and Greg?" the judge asked him. "Yes, I do," Herb replied. I was stunned. Why didn't he love me? The judge was now turning to Don. "Don Brinkley, do you accept full parental responsibilities to be the father of Christy and Greg?" he asked. "Yes, absolutely," Don said. I suddenly felt a huge sense of relief, realizing that I would never be whipped, spanked, rubbed raw with towels, or made to gag on soap again. She dreamed of being an artist in France and moved there at age 19. One day, she was approached by a photographer. If you're not a model, you should be, he said. You could earn a lot of money. Is this really this guy's best line? I'd love it if you came by my studio so I could take a few pictures of you, the man continued, jotting down his name. He explained that he wanted to take test photos of me to show his client and the agency. Agency? I asked. Yes, he said. Agencies represent models. They're the ones who will find you work. If they do, you'll get paid 1,000 francs per day for editorial work. My jaw hit the studio floor. That was the equivalent to $200, more than I made in an entire week illustrating for Air France. She met with Ford Models co-founder Eileen Ford. You've got a look, honey, she said. You do have to lose a little weight. I'm going to recommend that you eat fish, only fish, and nothing but fish. Wow, this is going to be tough. Not only did I dislike dieting, but also I had been a vegetarian since age 14. But her fresh-faced, full-figured look led her to her first Sports Illustrated shoot in 1974 in Mexico. Told to go out and work on her tan, she wound up with a pink sunburn. Let's go with it, editorial director Julie Campbell said, tossing me a pink bikini bottom and pink shawl. We can tie the shawl in different ways, and it'll look so sexy, like you're wearing nothing on top. That's because I won't be, I thought. That evening, I was all nerves as I stood in front of the photographer, Walter Ayos. Making matters worse, the shawl was stringy and slippery, stitched from real silk, and I didn't know how to pose in it. So I kept fidgeting, moving my hands up and down my body. Whatever I was doing, though, worked like a charm. Smoky, Walter yelled to me. You're so smoking that I'm going to start calling you Smoky. Suddenly, modeling swimsuits didn't seem so tough. In 1983, she met the charming and hilarious Billy Joel at a motel bar in St. Bart's. The man was sunburned to a crisp, his face the same color as cranberries and unctus with oil, which he'd undoubtedly slathered on to soothe the burn, topped by what I like to call the Long Island bubble, a carapace of curly, shellacked hair popular in the 1980s in parts of suburban New York. I wasn't sure if his name was Billy Joe or Billy Joel, and not wanting to insult him, I decided to play it safe. You look like a Joe to me, I said. When I first heard him sing on stage, I found myself undeniably attracted to this physically hot and intellectually charismatic man. I went back to his penthouse apartment in the St. Moritz building. It was late at night. All I could see were the lights of other high-rise buildings glittering in the distance through his apartment's giant oversized windows, which looked out over Central Park. Directly in front of the windows was a grand piano where Billy sat and, flashing me a smile, began to play New York State of Mind. Soon he was calling and sending her flowers every day. On August 7th, 1984, they got engaged. I was going to wait until tonight, but this thing is burning a hole in my pocket, he said, as he handed me a single sheet of paper. On the paper was the last and final verse of Leave a Tender Moment Alone. I read it slowly before I couldn't read it out loud anymore because I was sobbing. Guess I must be in love much more than I thought I could be. Yes, I'm sure I'm in love, so please say that you'll marry me. Yes, Joe, I whispered through tears. They wed on March 23, 1985, on a boat on the Hudson River. To steady myself, I clutched the necklace Billy had given me, made up of multiple strands of baby pearls, anchored by a triangular emerald crusted by diamonds. But that didn't stop me from throwing up. I was that nervous. Thankfully, I recovered in time for the ceremony. As soon as we said our I do's, a recording of James Brown's voice boomed throughout the boat. Wow, I feel good. I knew that I would. As everyone leapt to their feet and started the party, which lasted all night long. After their daughter, Alexa Ray, was born, Billy and Christy were staying in their rental house in Montauk while they were building their dream home. But one night in 1986, after falling asleep in Billy's arms, she woke up and he was nowhere to be found. I knew I couldn't call the police, which would only result in an article in the gossip columns next day. Instead, I called every local bar. My heart began to settle when the bartender at the fourth place told me that yes, Billy Joel was there. The next day, he said he didn't remember anything from the night before, as he told me how much he loved me, how stressed he'd been writing songs for his new album, The Bridge, and that it would never happen again. In 1991, while Christy and Billy were on their way home from Australia and staying at a hotel in Hawaii, photos surfaced of Billy with an Australian actress. Upset, Christy told him to find somewhere else to sleep. He left the room outraged, and when he came back later that night, visibly and audibly drunk, I had already locked the doors. When I didn't answer, he picked up a chaise lounge and threw it right through the doors of the patio, shattering the glass into a million pieces. To be clear, I never wanted to end things with Billy. But his drinking was bigger than the both of us. To this day, Billy continues to deny ever having had affairs, and I've always believed him. Christy and Billy divorced in 1994, and she rebounded with Colorado real estate developer Ricky Taubman, who invited her to go heli-skiing. We had already taken two runs and were circling to land for a third, on the saddle of a faraway peak, when the helicopter just fell from the sky, plunging into a free fall from 300 feet overhead. The helicopter smacked into the granite mountain with such terrible force that it split in two. I kept repeating Alexa Ray's name like a mantra, praying that I wouldn't feel the helicopter blades when they sliced through my neck. Then suddenly, I felt a tug on my leg, and I realized with horror that my seatbelt strap had somehow wrapped itself around my ski boot, even though it was still attached to the wreckage, which was sliding and dragging me down the mountain toward a sheer granite cliff. Rescue helicopters arrived, and she was taken to the hospital with severe contusions. She learned Ricky almost died. By that time, the doctors had already given me morphine for the pain, and in a drug-induced haze, I began to think that if Ricky survived, I had to do everything possible to see him. We hadn't even kissed yet, but suddenly, there I was, making love to a man in a hospital bed as he lay hooked up to all kinds of machines as tubes and IVs twisted around and over us. I started to look forward to his calls, when we shared what we could remember about the crash, which only deepened the trauma bond between us, a term I only later learned. When he said the words that I had wanted to hear from Billy following the crash, things like, "I thought you might have died, and I realized I couldn't let you die because I needed to see you and be with you," I felt carried up by a wave of emotion. They married in 1994, but she left him within a year, after he had borrowed nearly $2 million from her. When she was 8 months pregnant with their son, Ricky requested a meeting. He casually dropped that he had tracked down my biological father and had even spoken with him by phone. I hadn't seen or talked with Herb Hudson since I was 8 years old. I told him to get out of my life. After their son, Jack, was born, he called again. "We're going to make a deal," he said. "I'm going to walk away from you and the baby, just like Herb Hudson did." In December 1995, Ricky agreed before a judge to relinquish his paternity rights to Jack. I felt numb, but also a sense of relief. And afterward, when I went back to my apartment and I saw Jack's sweet face light up, I knew everything was going to be okay. Even though she wasn't interested in dating, a friend introduced her to architect Peter Cook in 1996. Things happened quickly after that, and for a number of reasons, primarily because I felt both a sense of urgency to find Jack a father figure and terror at the thought that Ricky might swoop back, I said yes when Peter asked me to marry him later that year. On September 21st, 1996, we were wed in the backyard. Billy came too, which delighted both Alexa Ray and me, and I couldn't have been happier that our friendship survived the divorce. On February 2nd, 2004, I turned 50, which felt like a massive milestone as a model. CoverGirl came back to me the following year when I was 51, asking me to re-sign with the brand so that I could rep its new line of cosmetics for women over 30. I was excited to show other women that we could make age into whatever we wanted it to be. But then life turned on a dime. In June 2006, she found out Cook was having an affair with an 18-year-old woman. Their divorce and custody battle over Jack and daughter Sailor made headlines for a month. Christy escaped with her kids to a remote ranch in Tall Timbers, Colorado. Every day, a weathered old man in the stables helped the kids saddle up their horses. One day, he turned to me and asked if I knew the name of the slender river that ran through the mountains. "It's called Animas," the old man said, "the river of lost souls. It always pulls people here when they're the most lost in life." He paused. "I know you're lost right now," he said, "but you've got your family. I know you'll find your footing, just like those horses do out on the trail." There were many times when I wondered if I would ever recover, but whenever I felt this, I counted my blessings, which always started with Alexa Ray, Jack, and Sailor. They taught me self-determination, independence, gratitude, how to see beauty in everything, and how to never stop dreaming. Uptown Girl and Her Downtown Guy. The night she and Billy Joel met in 1983. "He definitely didn't look like a rock star," she says. The director kept saying, "More hoity-toity, Christy," she says of their 1983 Uptown Girl video. Their 1985 wedding. We called each other bada bing and bada boom, she says. He was smitten with daughter Alexa Ray, she says. He was writing all these songs and saying, this one's for you, she says. Secrets of Her Sizzle. Hot Shot. Rather scandalous in 1977, this Norma Kamali swimsuit was a bunch of strings with a couple little pieces of fabric, she says. National Lampoon's Vacation. She flirted with Chevy Chase from a Ferrari and initially thought the 1983 hit would be a little family movie. Beach Beauties. With her daughters, Alexa Ray and Sailor, in a very empowering 2016 shoot for Sports Illustrated. Rosy Glow. After getting a bad sunburn before a 1974 SI shoot, she was told the pink bikini will match your pink cheeks. Sexy Scrub. Rubbing sand on her body to exfoliate resulted in a new look for her 1983 calendar. Her early years. Writing about her biological father's abuse wasn't easy, says Christy. I remember the belt and his threats to send me to an orphanage. I get instantly choked up, but it needed to be said. Her 1968 yearbook photo from the Los Angeles Lycee Francis. I wanted to go for the beautiful language and the beret, she says. I was very artsy. Before moving to Paris in 1973, she called friends to say goodbye. And in the mid-70s in Paris, she began working as an illustrator and began modeling. You have been listening to a People Magazine exclusive, Christy Brinkley, Life is an Adventure. John Lennon and Yoko Ono's Heartbreak, The Lost Daughter. As they campaigned for world peace, the couple were fighting to reunite their family after Ono's child was kidnapped by her ex. A powerful new documentary explores the story behind the search for Kyoko by Jordan Runta. This is from People Magazine. In August 1971, John Lennon and Yoko Ono left their home in England to begin a new chapter in New York City. Settling in the West Village, they fell in with a colorful crowd of radical activists. The flurry of peace marches, TV appearances, and charity concerts that followed obscured the real reason for their move. They were desperately searching for Kyoko Cox, Ono's missing 8-year-old daughter. Kyoko was Ono's only child from her previous marriage to American artist Anthony Cox. After losing a bitter custody battle, Cox violated a court order and fled with the girl. Lennon and Ono had spent the better part of a year waging legal battles and trailing them across multiple continents. When reports surfaced that Cox and Kyoko were hiding in the U.S., the couple relocated to continue the search. The new documentary, 121, John and Yoko, now playing in select IMAX theaters, offers an immersive look at their first 15 months in America. It features newly restored footage from their only full-length concerts, two 1972 benefit shows at Madison Square Garden for the Willowbrook State School, which served children with developmental disabilities. The film also incorporates private phone recordings that capture Ono's aching sense of loss. John and I will be watching TV, and there will be a child. I can't bear seeing children because it reminds me of Kyoko, she said in one taped call. This story was never a secret, but it somehow got lost in the maelstrom of everything else that was going on. The documentary's co-director, Kevin McDonald, tells People. Throughout this period, she's a mother in pain who's trying to find her child. That's the core of this film. Cox evaded his superstar ex by disappearing into America's heartland with Kyoko. Living under assumed names, they joined a religious sect called the Church of the Living Word, which provided secrecy. Lennon and Ono spent more than $1.5 million, adjusted for inflation, on private investigators chasing false leads. When these efforts failed, Ono made numerous public appeals through national TV interviews and by releasing songs like Don't Worry, Kyoko. She poured her agony into action. After seeing a news segment about the horrific conditions at Willowbrook, she and Lennon staged two benefit concerts on August 30th, 1972. She's a mother in pain, explains McDonald. That's why she connected so deeply to the Willowbrook footage. She's thinking of her own child she can't help. Ono received a sympathetic telegram from Kyoko in the aftermath of Lennon's death in 1980. She and Lennon welcomed son Sean in 1975. It contained no contact information. Ono responded with a public letter. All these years, there has not been one day I have not missed you, she wrote. If you ever wish to get in touch with me, know that I love you deeply. A reunion finally came in 1994 when Kyoko, then in her 30s and working as a Colorado-based artist, called her mother shortly before the birth of her first child. It was the first time they'd spoken in 23 years. A personal meeting soon followed, and they gradually rebuilt their bond. Though Kyoko prefers to stay out of the spotlight, she reportedly remains close to Ono, now 92. When Kyoko finally appeared, I was totally in shock, Ono told People in 2003. It felt like the part of me that was missing came back. This has been John Lennon and Yoko Ono's Heartbreak, The Lost Daughter, from People Magazine. You are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer broadcaster, Kelly Pyle, and this is the Women's Hour. Prince Harry's high-stake fight. The Duke of Sussex is navigating a critical moment, caught between a pivotal courtroom clash over his UK security and an increasingly fractured relationship with his father, the King. By Simon Perry from People Magazine. When Prince Harry stepped out of London's Royal Courts of Justice on April 9th, he admitted to People that he felt exhausted and overwhelmed. At stake was his appeal to restore automatic state-funded security when he's in the UK, which he lost in 2020 after he and Meghan, Duchess of Sussex, made the life-altering decision to step back from their royal roles. Frustrated and disillusioned by what he's uncovered in years of fighting, the Duke of Sussex, 40, says his worst fears have been confirmed by the whole legal disclosure in this case, and that's really sad. Over the course of two emotionally charged days, Harry listened closely as his legal team argued for the return of the police protection he had from birth. Though Harry has become a familiar figure in Britain's courtrooms, fighting back against the UK tabloid press with unyielding resolve, the security case has always mattered the most, he says. This isn't just a legal appeal for him. It's a fight to protect Meghan and their children, Prince Archie 5 and Princess Lilibet 3, and perhaps a final chance at reconciliation with his father, King Charles. Indeed, the courtroom tensions mirror the personal rift between father and son. Charles's advisors are directly tied to Ravec, the government's royal and executive VIP committee, which is denying Harry's protection. One of Harry's core beliefs is that the removal of official security was a calculated attempt to control him and Meghan, 43, and to deter them from stepping away from royal life and starting a new chapter outside the UK. But in Harry's view, the decision only revealed the lengths to which the palace was willing to go and became his final straw. He admits that this realization was difficult to swallow and has deepened an already raw rift. Amid the tumult, Harry feels his father, who serves as the ceremonial head of state, could easily intervene and have his security reinstated, though the palace has consistently denied this. For Harry, the situation echoes the painful history of his childhood. He sees chilling parallels between his own situation and that of his late mother, Princess Diana, who, after her divorce from Charles in 1996, was left without police protection after choosing to decline it. Diana died in a 1997 car crash in Paris, where she had been pursued by paparazzi and guarded only by private security. Now Harry is determined to avoid the same fate for Meghan, Archie, Lilibet, and himself. His presence here and throughout this appeal, his lawyer, Shahid Fatima, told the court, is a potent demonstration of how much this appeal means to him and his family. The legal case isn't Harry's only source of strain. In March, he and Prince Seeso of Lesotho, who co-founded the African-based charity Sentebale, stepped down as patrons amid internal conflict. Harry, who founded the organization in 2006 at age 21 in memory of his mother, has long considered it a cornerstone of his humanitarian legacy. Though Harry says he's relieved the matter is under formal review, it's clear that in court, his focus was squarely on one thing, keeping his own family safe. And that safety comes at staggering price. With no access to state-funded protection, the Sussexes now rely on private security, which is estimated at anywhere from $150,000 to $300,000 a month, a cost they've shouldered themselves. If the UK acknowledges the threat to them, other countries are likely to follow suit and provide protection. This financial strain is one of the key reasons they moved quickly to secure high-profile deals, a Netflix contract rumored at $100 million, a now-ending $20 million Spotify partnership, and Harry's multi-million-dollar spare book deal. But perhaps the steepest cost of all is the widening gulf between Harry and his father. Their last face-to-face meeting was a brief 30-minute encounter in February 2024, shortly after Charles, 76, publicly revealed his cancer diagnosis. Queen Camilla, 77, was present, and there have been no private father-son conversations since. Sources close to Harry say his calls and letters now go unanswered. The estrangement is so profound that Harry learned of his father's March 27th hospitalization related to complications from treatment through the media. Friends note that during each of Harry's last three UK visits, Charles has been unavailable, including this month, despite Harry's court date having long been scheduled and known ahead of the King's overlapping state visit to Italy. Harry remains in the dark about the King's current condition and prognosis. "I don't think there is any rapprochement," says a source close to the palace. "Nothing has changed." Those close to Harry believe the King is deliberately keeping his distance, in part to avoid being drawn into discussions about security. The legal battle puts Harry in direct contact with the people who are carrying out the King's orders, says royal author Sally Bettle Smith. If his father was to say something even seemingly innocuous, it could end up landing in the middle of the court case. Still, another source with close palace ties pushes back, saying a distinction between personal life and official duties could be made, but things have been like this for a while. The same is true of Harry's fractured relationship with his brother Prince William, 42, who also hasn't responded to calls or messages from Harry. While Harry still hopes for reconciliation, trust remains a major hurdle. The fallout from Spare, Harry's candid memoir that exposed private conversations and long-held tensions, continues to weigh heavily on their relationship. "These are things that would have been considered confidential," Bedell Smith notes. At the same time, Harry wants Archie and Lilibet to connect with their UK roots, experience their heritage, and build relationships with extended family. Harry maintains close ties with other members of the royal family, most notably his cousin, Princess Eugenie. "Their bond has always been strong and will remain so," sources say. "One of the key reasons his family relocated to California," Harry says, "was the ability to employ armed private security, something that had become essential amid growing social media threats, intrusion attempts, and credible safety concerns." Neil Basu, a former head of counterterrorism for the Metropolitan Police, has publicly confirmed that Meghan faced serious threats during her time in the UK, and that both she and Harry were considered among the highest risk members of the royal family. When their taxpayer-funded protection was withdrawn in 2020, Harry was granted what officials described as a bespoke security arrangement, a system crafted by Ravec to address the unique situation of a royal heir choosing to live abroad. Under this process, Harry and his family must give 28 days notice ahead of any trip to the UK, with each visit reviewed on a case-by-case basis, and protection isn't always granted. Harry has been challenging that decision ever since. Though he lost the initial case in February 2024, he was granted the right to appeal. In the April 8th hearing, his lawyer argued that Ravec had failed to properly assess the risks to Harry and his family, bypassing the Risk Management Board, a panel meant to provide expert threat analysis. His legal team contended that Ravech had diverted from its usual procedures, leaving Harry singled out for different, unjustified, and inferior treatment, and excluded from the same protections given to other high-profile figures in the other VIP category, including pop stars and former prime ministers. Sir James Eady, a lawyer for the UK Home Office, countered that argument, claiming the different approach was necessary in light of Harry's unique circumstances. While much of the hearing was conducted in private because of the sensitive nature of the case, Harry has been shaken by some of the information that emerged during the proceedings. "People would be shocked by what's being held back," Harry said. Following the hearing, a source close to Harry's legal team said they were cautiously optimistic about the outcome. A ruling is expected in the coming weeks. Harry found solace from the stressful case on April 10th, making a surprise visit to Ukraine alongside colleagues from the Invictus Games, his adaptive sports initiative for wounded, sick, and injured service members, to tour a rehabilitation center. The next installment of the Games is set for 2027 in Birmingham, UK. Under normal circumstances, Harry would be expected to attend with Meghan by his side. Whether the family will return to the UK for it, however, remains uncertain. Despite UK tabloid reports painting him as isolated and unhappy, Harry has fully embraced his California lifestyle while honing his surfing skills, enjoying evenings out with Meghan and close friends, and finding renewed purpose in his work. In addition to his continued leadership with the Invictus Games and the couple's Archwell Foundation, Harry has spent the past 5 years investing, both publicly and privately, in companies that reflect his humanitarian values. At home, parenthood is their focus. Archie and Lilibet are the center of their world in Montecito, where they've created what a source calls a happy bubble. The kids are adorable. They're incredibly smart, articulate, and fun, the insider says, of traits that have been glimpsed through Meghan's recent return to social media. Harry has also been a constant presence for Meghan as she stepped back into the spotlight this spring with the launch of her Netflix series and her lifestyle brand As Ever. "I'm so happy for my wife and fully support absolutely everything she's done and continues to do," Harry tells People. "I'm incredibly proud." To mark the milestone, the family enjoyed a sun-soaked spring break getaway. Regardless of the outcome of the legal case, Harry says he is driven by exposing injustice and a desire to get under the bonnet and fix what's broken. His determination is deeply personal. If anything were to happen to Meghan or their two young children, he could never rest, says a source close to the situation. He feels very strongly this is something he must fight for. With reporting by Pernilla Sedenheim and Aaron Hill, you've been listening to Prince Harry's High Stakes Fight from People. Simple Twists: 5 Brilliant Gardening Tricks That Actually Work. Each one gets 2 green thumbs up from us. by Lisa Friedman, Real Simple Magazine. Use cardboard boxes to kill weeds and grass. Let's say you want to take some yard space and turn it into a flower bed. Cardboard can help. Lay your broken down boxes, plain brown cardboard with tape and staples removed, in the shape of your desired bed. Wet them with a hose and mulch right over them. You'll have a barrier for weeds and grass, and over time, the cardboard will simply decompose. Use a wire wastebasket to protect plants. No bunny likes it when rascally rabbits treat budding garden beds like all-you-can-eat salad bars. To keep them away, pick up a bunch of wire wastebaskets from the dollar store and stake one upside down over each plant or small grouping. Not today, little guys, not today. Use a bar of soap to keep your fingernails clean. If you're reading this items so far and are like, no duh, keep reading. This tip is all about being proactive, not reactive. Before you head outside, scratch a bar of soap until it accumulates under your nails. This will help prevent dirt from getting in there so you can dig around without gloves. When you wash up, the soap should dissolve with minimal scrubbing. Use a muffin tin to measure plots for seeds. Put down the yardstick and grab a muffin tin. Push the bakeware into the soil face up to create an evenly spaced grid of indentations. You can then put seeds into every well or every other well, following whatever spacing and depth the seed packets suggest. Way easier than measuring. Use baby oil and sand to keep tools rust-free. A smart way to store your metal hand trowel and shears? In a bucket filled with sand and a bit of baby oil. The generally recommended ratio is 5 gallons of sand to 1 quart of oil. It'll help the tool stay free of rust and ready to grab. Bonus, the abrasive sand can scrub off clumps of dirt if you wiggle the tools around. With illustrations by Sunny Eckery, you've been listening to 5 brilliant gardening tricks that actually work. Christy Teigen on her son's diabetes journey. Miles is a warrior. Nearly a year after her 6-year-old son was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, the Cravings founder opens up about tackling the chronic disease as a family by Melody Chu from People. As a mom of 4, Christy Teigen thrives on being a planner. If they have football season coming up, I've got to get that gear. If Luna has a recital, I've got to get that costume going. The entrepreneur says of raising her oldest daughter, 9, and siblings, Miles, 6, Esty, 2, and Ren, 22 months. There's no other way to go about this life. Still, Teigen, 39, learned in the toughest of ways last summer that there are some things she and her husband, John Legend, 46, simply can't plan for. In July 2024, the superstar couple revealed that Miles had been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, a chronic condition in which the pancreas makes little to no insulin after a terrible case of Shigella landed him in the hospital during football camp. It really took Miles down harder than a lot of the other kids, she recalls, of the common bacterial infection that affects the digestive system. His pain was incredible, and he's a pretty tough little boy. After 3 full days of blood test after blood test at Cedars-Sinai Hospital, doctors confirm Miles, who had previously shown no symptoms, was facing type 1. We were thrown into this world of chaos and having to learn so much all at once, says Tegan, of grappling with her son's autoimmune disease, which can lead to life-threatening complications affecting the heart, blood vessels, nerves, and kidneys if left untreated. Nearly a year later, Tegan and Legend have settled into a new normal, prioritizing Miles' physical and emotional health while balancing the needs of all their kids. Everything was put on pause. We were finding ourselves going in and out of hospitals, sitting down with our notebooks, taking copious notes, and taking videos of everything someone was doing with the insulin jar, she says. When they first returned home, Miles was asking, "Why me? How come not Luna?" she recalls. He was really worried that it would affect if he could play sports. Can I have candy still? All those things that only a kid would worry about. She and Legend bought stacks of books about diabetes for Miles, but I found myself reading more children's books than maybe he was even, she says. It put it in terms that are so easy to understand. One of the most difficult parts of Miles' treatment for Tegan is administering his daily insulin injections. You try everything, tokens, bribery, iPad time. You do everything you can to see what makes him comfortable, she says, growing emotional. The first 3 months were really, really tough for us as a family because your child is experiencing pain. Tegan admits there are still ups and downs. One day you're like, he did it, and you're so excited, it's all looking up. Then all of a sudden, the next day is so difficult again, she says. I've always said this about having kids in general, and it fits in with this too. When things are going so great, you can always count on it to turn. And when things are really rough, things are going to get better. Our family's really good about navigating those curveballs now. Tegan and her family leaned on their village, including strangers who flooded her Instagram with support after Miles' diagnosis. Now she hopes to advocate for others who are at high risk of developing the disease. Genetics is a factor. To get screened early. It doesn't prevent type 1, but it is going to prepare you for it. I cannot tell you how much it changed our life so quickly, says Tegan, who's partnering with Sanofi Screen for type 1 movement. We went straight from the hospital to home, and I would have loved to have made more mistakes pricking an orange than I did on Miles. While her son is only 6 years old, she can already see the impact sharing his story has made. I know how much it means for Miles to see himself in anybody. Some people have sent us videos of their friends that are soccer players who live with type 1, and you see his eyes light up, she says. I told him, Miles, you get to be that now for other people. How cool is that? He really is a little warrior. Why early testing is so important. Like many other T1 moms, Tegan had no idea early screening existed for type 1 diabetes, which is estimated to affect 2 million Americans. Often low or even no cost, depending on insurance, an autoantibody blood screening looks for diabetes-related autoantibodies even before symptoms surface. Visit screenfortype1.com/make-a-pledge to learn more. You've been listening to Miles is a Warrior from People. Thanks for joining us today for the Women's Hour. My name is Kelly Pyle, and I am your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. I hope you enjoyed the stories in our program today, and I also hope you'll make plans to join us again next week for another entertaining collection of articles from women's magazines. And don't forget, you can take Sun Sounds with you. You can stream as well as access shows on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Have a great day, and be sure to stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.